morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, we're going to open up the phones today and take some calls from listeners. We're also going to talk about Hollywood movies, and we'll take a look at It's a Wonderful Life, how the FBI thought it was communist propaganda. We'll also hear what the president said last night about COVID-19. And later on in the program, we'll open up the phones and get your take on all these issues. President Trump is threatening to torpedo Congress's massive pandemic relief package in the midst of the raging pandemic and deep economic uncertainty. He's suddenly demanding changes that fellow Republicans have opposed, like a huge increase in the $600 payments planned for most Americans. Trump assailed the bipartisan $900 billion package in a video that he tweeted out last night and suggested that he may not sign it. Let's listen to what the president said last night.
Throughout the summer, Democrats cruelly blocked COVID relief legislation in an effort to advance their extreme left-wing agenda and influence the election. Then, a few months ago, Congress started negotiations on a new package to get urgently needed help to the American people. It's taken forever. However, the bill they are now planning to send back to my desk is much different than anticipated. It really is a disgrace. For example, among the more than 5,000 pages in this bill, which nobody in Congress has read because of its length and complexity, it's called the COVID relief bill, but it has almost nothing to do with COVID. This bill contains $85.5 million for assistance to Cambodia, $134 million to Burma, $1.3 billion for Egypt, and the Egyptian military, which will go out and buy almost exclusively Russian military equipment. $25 million for democracy and gender programs in Pakistan. $505 million to Belize, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Panama. $40 million for the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., which is not even open for business. $1 billion for the Smithsonian, and an additional $154 million for the National Gallery of Art. Likewise, these facilities are essentially not open. $7 million for reef fish management, $25 million to combat Asian carp, $2.5 million to count the number of amberjack fish in the Gulf of Mexico, a provision to promote the breeding of fish in federal hatcheries, $3 million in poultry production technology, $2 million to research the impact of downed trees, $566 million for construction projects at the FBI. The bill also allows stimulus checks for the family members of illegal aliens, allowing them to get up to $1,800 each. This is far more than the Americans are given. Despite all of this wasteful spending and much more, the $900 billion package provides hardworking taxpayers with only $600 each in relief payments. And not enough money is given to small businesses, and in particular restaurants, whose owners have suffered so grievously. They were only given a deduction for others to use in business their restaurant for 2 years. This 2-year period must be withdrawn, which will allow the owners to obtain financing and get their restaurants back in condition. Congress can terminate it at a much later date, but 2 years is not acceptable. It's not enough. Congress found plenty of money for foreign countries, lobbyists, and special interests while sending the bare minimum to the American people who need it. It wasn't their fault. It was China's fault, not their fault. I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple. I'm also asking Congress to immediately get rid of the wasteful and unnecessary items from this legislation and to send me a suitable bill, or else the next administration will have to deliver a COVID relief package, and maybe that administration will be me. and we will get it done. Thank you very much.
President Trump last night in a tweet, a video message that he sent out via tweet, threatening to torpedo Congress's massive pandemic relief package. He wants the $600 payments planned for many Americans to be increased to $2,000 per person. Now, the president described relief for restaurants in a different way. The Associated Press is reporting this about the so-called relief for restaurants. Stuffed into the new COVID relief package is a special interest gift that President Trump has long had on his economic wish list, restoring full tax breaks for restaurant business meals. Critics deride it as a return of the three martini lunch giveaway to businesses. The provision in the bill restores the full tax deduction prized by businesses and lobbyists for fine dining and schmoozing. So that's the way it's being reported elsewhere. We haven't seen a fact check on what the president said there, but I think the fact checks will come out. We'll see what they say later today. If you want to comment, you can send an email into us at dj@wmnf.org. President Trump has pardoned four former private government contractors convicted in a 2007 civilian massacre in Baghdad. It left more than a dozen Iraqi civilians dead and caused an international uproar over the use of private security guards in a war zone. Supporters of the former contractors at Blackwater had lobbied for the pardons, arguing that the men had been excessively punished already. All four were serving lengthy prison sentences. The pardons reflect Trump's apparent willingness to give the benefit of the doubt to American military contractors when it comes to acts of violence in war zones against civilians. And a new Gallup poll shows the president's job approval rating is the lowest it's been since June. It's down to 39%. Well, again, if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Well, every holiday season, millions of people cozy up in front of the television and watch a very old film from 1946. It's called It's a Wonderful Life. The film was directed by Frank Capra. It's considered one of his best. It follows the down-on-his-luck George Bailey. Bailey's played by Jimmy Stewart. He's a businessman in a fictional town of Bedford Falls who's about to lose his savings and loan company to the rich, evil banker, Mr. Potter. Bailey considers committing suicide on Christmas Eve, deciding his family and the townspeople would be better off without him. But a guardian angel appears. The angel presents Bailey an alternative timeline in which Bailey doesn't exist, and shows the man how much he's helped those people around him. As I mentioned, it stars Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed. The movie was a commercial and critical success, earning 5 Oscar nominations, including one for Best Picture. In 1990, the Library of Congress inducted the film into the National Film Registry. But the FBI was not so hot about the film. Back in the 40s, J. Edgar Hoover's communist hunting agents thought it was a Trojan horse, sneaking anti-American propaganda to the masses. The argument was compiled in a memo written by an unnamed special agent in the FBI's Los Angeles field office about communist infiltration of the motion picture industry. From 1942 to 1958, the Los Angeles field office investigated more than 200 movies, fearing they had been turned into weapons of communist propaganda. John Noakes is a scholar. He is a professor at Franklin and Marshall College. He wrote in a book called The Cold War Movies that the FBI generally looked into films connected to personalities associated with the Communist Party, which is what drew them to It's a Wonderful Life. I spoke with John Noakes about the investigation into It's a Wonderful Life, and here's the interview that I did with John.
I was a scholar of the FBI, and I was sent a set of microfilm to review by an academic journal. And the microfilm, amongst the microfilm collections, were the sort of complete records that had been released about FBI surveillance in Hollywood in the 1940s and 50s. So in the process of reviewing that material, I came across what I thought was a fascinating example of how the FBI actually had to make a decision about what was subversive in a movie.
Hmm. Why was the FBI interested in this?
The FBI was interested sort of in everything at that time. So the more specific answer here is that they believed that communists were going to try to use the movies to infiltrate the American psyche, to sort of plant ideas about why communism was good and capitalism was bad.
there's no doubt that there were people who were left-wing in Hollywood in the 1930s and 40s, is there?
There's no doubt there was, and many of them were quite open about it. What I find fascinating is that I think the FBI misunderstood what it meant to create a movie and sort of thought that people would just go in and sort of just put all this propaganda in movies and the American public would just consume it without any understanding or concern about what it was. If you look at it from their perspective, the other thing I find fascinating is how much they missed. So if you look at It's a Wonderful Life, they were concerned about its official credited writers, you know, who hung out with communists, who talked to communists, because it was Hollywood in the 40s. Everybody, you know, like as you were suggesting, lots of people were on the left, and it was pretty difficult not to know or hang out with people who had left-wing views. What they totally miss is that several of the people who wrote early drafts of the script, some of the material which found its way into the actual movie, had far greater left-wing credentials than the actual writers, Hackett and Goodrich. So Dalton Trumbo, Clifford Odets, Dorothy Parker, all took shots at the script as it was being developed, and pieces of what they wrote found their way into the final version of the movie.
There are FBI documents out there in which the FBI is quoting somebody in Hollywood who says that this is pretty typical of communist propaganda. Do we know who that person was that was speaking to the FBI?
We don't know the informants. What we do know, this is a part I find fascinating, is that the document that the FBI agents in Los Angeles used to determine what made a movie subversive was written by a group of conservative screenwriters and directors in Hollywood. And the lead author on that was Ayn Rand.
Very interesting. Well, I guess there are a lot of scenes in It's a Wonderful Life that seem to set off the FBI. I'm going to play now this scene where there's a kind of a confrontation between Mr. Potter, who's the bad guy in It's a Wonderful Life. He's the big banker. He owns the big bank there in the town. And Jimmy Stewart, and this is where Potter, I think, really outlines his philosophy, where he says, why are you treating these rabble so well to Jimmy Stewart? And Jimmy Stewart kind of gets up and defends it.
But ideals without common sense can ruin this town. Now, you take this loan here, the Ernie Bishop, you know, that fellow that sits around all day on his brains in his taxi, you know. I happen to know the bank turned down this loan, but he comes here, and we're building him a house worth $5,000. Why?
Well, I handled that, Mr. Potter. You have all the papers there, his salary, insurance. I can personally vouch for his character.
Friend of yours?
Yes, sir.
You see, if you shoot pool with some employee here, you can come and borrow money. What does that get us? A discontented, lazy rabble instead of a thrifty working class. And all because a few starry-eyed dreamers like Peter Bailey stir them up and fill their head with a lot of impossible ideas. Now, I say...
Just a minute now. Hold on, Mr. Potter. Just a minute. Now, you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny-ante building alone, I'll never know, but neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character, because his whole life was... Why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Well, here, you're all businessmen here. Don't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... What'd you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that they... Do you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath?
Is this one of those segments where... the FBI thought, okay, now here's an example of communist propaganda?
This is a key scene for the FBI. So the FBI thought there were two things that made a movie subversive. One was that it slighted or criticized American institutions, and the other was that it promoted or celebrated communist institutions. So here you have a scene where Potter is being portrayed in a very negative light and talking very negatively about the American working class, basically. And then you have this defense coming from Jimmy Stewart, where he, the Jimmy Stewart character, George Bailey, where he sort of celebrates the American working class. These are the people who do most of the living and dying in this town, he says. So what you have in this scene is really a conflict between two kinds of capitalism and two kinds of banking. You have the sort of monopoly capitalist who's concerned only with profit, and then you have the Jimmy Stewart character, the sort of small-town savings and loan bank kind of capitalist who's concerned about a community and about the people who are their his customers. I will note that Jimmy Stewart doesn't criticize capitalism here. What he criticizes is a kind of heartless capitalism. And he says in his big speech that treating people well makes them better citizens and better customers.
Hmm. It's sort of like the conflict that we have today between small businesses who are being eaten up by these large big box stores that come into town.
I think that's a parallel. I think that parallel is apt.
So the FBI thought It's a Wonderful Life was filled with this kind of subversion.
Well, it had in its belief it was critical of bankers because Potter was the most hated man in the movie, and it celebrated the common man in that speech by Jimmy Stewart. The irony, of course, is that the movie is all about bankers. The Bailey family is at the center of the movie, and they are bankers.
And that's to your point that Jimmy Stewart really was defending capitalism, although he was defending small capitalism.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, so where did this go? I mean, did the FBI put It's a Wonderful Life on some sort of subversive list, or Frank Capra, the director, on some sort of list?
So they had files, and their names were kept in the files. The problem that Hoover soon realized was that while his agents were seen as experts on communism, or believed they were experts on communism, they weren't seen in the general public as expert on films. So usually when the FBI investigated someone and decided that they were subversive, nobody could really contest it because it was based on information that most people would never see. We heard this person at a meeting give a speech. We know that this person was having communications with this person. But when it came to movies, the FBI realized, I think, fairly quickly that the entire American public, for a small fee, could walk down the street and watch the same movie they were talking about and decide for itself whether it was subversive or not. So Hoover quickly sort of backed away from taking this information public. And what he did instead was he simply turned it all over to HUAC. And at the time, HUAC was having a lot of difficulty getting information. And Hoover considered them to be amateurs, and he really wasn't particularly supportive of the organization. But once he realized that he wasn't going to be able to take this information public, because his next step would have had to be to bring charges against somebody. And if he brings charges against somebody, not only does he have the public relations issue of everyone can see the movie, but he's got to go to court and prove it.
Hmm.
If he goes through HUAC, all he has to do is give the information to the Senate committee, which has very different which has very different rules and could engage in the kind of public shaming that they did without really having to prove their case.
I want to play a little bit of a documentary about HUAC, the House Un-American Affairs Committee, and its investigation. And we're going to hear from Gary Cooper, Ronald Reagan, Robert Taylor. We'll hear about the Hollywood Ten, John Howard Lawson, Dalton Trumbo, and Ring Lardner Jr., all of whom were either testified before HUAC or who lost their careers because of the investigation. But I want, after we hear the sound, John, I want you to put it in context for the times. This is from 1947. It's the year following 1946, which was the year that It's a Wonderful Life was released.
At home, Americans feared red subversion. Congress revived the House Committee on Un-American Activities. In 1947, the committee investigated Hollywood, factory of America's imagination.
Have you ever observed any communistic information in any scripts?
Well, I had turned down quite a few scripts because I thought they were tinged with communistic ideas. They haven't attempted to use me, I don't think, because apparently, They know that I'm not very sympathetic to communism.
There has been a small group within the Screen Actors Guild which has consistently opposed the policy of the Guild board and officers, or the Guild itself, as evidenced by the vote on various issues. That small clique has been referred to, has been discussed as more or less following the tactics that we associate with the Communist Party.
If I had my way about it, they'd all be sent back to Russia or some other unpleasant place.
10 witnesses, the Hollywood 10, defied the committee's right to ask about their beliefs.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It's unfortunate and tragic that I have to teach this committee the basic principles of Americanism.
That's not the question. The question is, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm framing my answer in the only way in which any American citizen can frame his
then
answer
you denied,
to the question
then
which
you,
invades his, absolutely invades
then
his
you
mind.
Then you deny, you refuse to answer that question, is that correct?
I have told you that I will
offer right.
my beliefs, my affiliations, and
here's
everything
the
else to the American public, and they will know where I stand, as they do from what I have written.
Stand away
I
from the stand.
I have written for Americanism for many years, and I shall
stand away from the stand.
Fight for the Bill of Rights, which
I'll
you are trying to
take
destroy.
This man away from the stand.
Others from the film industry demonstrated their support for the constitutional rights of the Ten.
Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I believe I have the right to be confronted with any evidence which supports this question. I should like to see what you have.
Oh, well, you would.
Yes.
Well, you will pretty soon. The witness is excused.
Either you completely cooperated with the committee, which meant saying yes or no to the question about whether you were a communist or ever had been. And if the answer was yes, as it was in my case, we knew the next question was who else was, and we certainly didn't want to go into that.
The 10 were imprisoned. With hundreds more, they were blacklisted, their livelihoods taken away.
People generally in Hollywood were pretty scared to have anything to do with us. Whereas before we went to prison, they had not been nearly as scared, and there were plenty of undercover arrangements that were made to write scripts under pseudonyms for a good deal less money than you were accustomed to being paid. There were a couple of possible suicides as a result of it. There were a good deal of misery.
Americans feared that the enemy would take advantage of their freedoms, that agents of communism were undermining America.
John, it seems like there was a sea change from 1945 at the end of World War II, where you see those famous photos of Soviet soldiers and American soldiers shaking hands, having defeated Nazi Germany. That's 1945. 1946, It's a Wonderful Life comes out. And then you've got a sea change of attitude towards Soviet Russia and communists in 1947.
Yeah, there's a sort of interesting thing that happens is that we are actually allies with the Soviet Union during World War II. And the movie industry is enlisted to create propaganda, basically, for the American government. Some of it is about how great things are in Russia, so us being allies is seen as an okay thing. Capra himself, who made It's a Wonderful Life, was making movies for the War Department. All that's ignored by the FBI when they start looking at movies after the post-war period. And in fact, some files from while the war was still going on and we were still allies with Soviet Union show that the FBI was suspicious of movie makers who were working for the government making movies on request about life in Russia because they were focusing so much time and attention on the Soviet Union.
Yeah, you mentioned that Dalton Trumbo and Dorothy Parker and others who were left-wingers in Hollywood didn't get credit for their role in writing the script or adding to the script of It's a Wonderful Life. Do we know how much they contributed?
They were part of a fairly normal process of people drafting scripts that got rejected by people who wanted to make the movie. At one point, Cary Grant was associated with the movie, and he had bought the rights, and it sort of went through several sort of normal processes in Hollywood. And as these scripts sort of accumulated, people would take bits and pieces of them. So there's nothing sort of very suspicious going on here. It's just a normal process. But I believe if the FBI had realized this, they would have been much more concerned about the movie, even more concerned about the movie.
Are you surprised at how we view It's a Wonderful Life these days, that it's shown nationally on television? It really has become kind of a family event. People gather around the TV and watch it year after year. Are you surprised what's happened to the film?
What surprises me is I've become quite a fan of the movie, and as a younger person, I just thought it was schmaltzy, and I just sort of ignored it. It's very dark movie. There's some scenes in it that are very bring a lot of sort of dramatic tension, and what surprises me is that it's so popular given the darkness of it. And I think the reason is because it's watched while lots of other things are going on, so people don't really pay attention to the full narrative, and they just sort of pick up parts of it that are quite heartwarming.
John, today there are people on TV who are looking for communists, and I want to just play a segment from Pajamas TV, which is a conservative media channel. And this is from Roger Simon, the film critic, and he's talking about examples of contemporary communism or left-wing activity in the movies. And I just want to get your take. I'm going to play about a minute of this. I want to get your take on this.
A motion picture called The Music Never Stopped, about a guy who's locked in time and can only be accessed through music, remembers his time in the 70s. And then he remembers what happened to his best friend. Turns out he was killed in Vietnam. And he goes on a rant. And here's the rant.
I'm sorry.
It's that asshole Nixon. Why can't people see that? You know, if people would just tune in for a second, they'd see what a son of a the guy is.
Of course, the point is, as you well know, when Nixon came to office, we had 575,000 troops in Vietnam. 2 years later, it was down to 45,000, and there was no draft.
Yeah, no DMV or food, no fridge, no Kennedys, and no what I used to chant, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?
You're one of those guys. hey, R&M, how many kids did you kill this AM?
Doesn't work.
But
anyway.
They are rewriting that history so that it's Nixon's war, war, and it never was.
Only old guys like us know, hey, hey, LBJ. Anyway, we laugh about all this stuff, but it's real serious. So what we'd like you to do is, if you see instances that are similar on television and film, please write into this new address, PollywoodLeftAlert@pjtv.com, and we'll share them with our viewers so we can analyze this stuff.
Well, that's Pajamas TV, a conservative media outlet, and they're on the lookout these days for communists in Hollywood. John, what do you make of that?
I mean, it's hard to know where to start here. There's a fundamental misunderstanding of the way ideas are transmitted that's expressed in this kind of approach. And most people who study this understand that when an idea is put out into the world, it's interpreted by people in a multiplicity of ways. There's no simple transmission of ideas, left-wing, right-wing, or otherwise. I thought that the best explanation of this was the great gay activist Harvey Milk said once about whether people were influenced by their teachers. He said, if people were so influenced by their teachers, there'd be a lot more nuns running around right now. And there's just this sort of fundamental idea that just because something is put out there or somebody puts out an idea, that nobody is able to sort of think critically and understand the idea. The other, I think, fundamental problem here is a misunderstanding about the nature of drama. Drama depends on conflict. And it's often shaped around conflict. So to create a story often means creating conflict. And when you create conflict, you create the good and the evil. And without it, it's very difficult to tell a good story. So, you know, the Academy Award winner in 1946 was a movie called The Best Years of Our Lives, a great film about coming back from the war. And in order to tell the story about former GIs, back in the United States, they created situations where they came into conflict with people in the United States, including people who might be employers or wealthy people who wanted flights on planes. And the FBI was very suspicious of that because it was criticizing American institutions. It's very difficult to do a good piece of drama without criticizing something. And I think that this misunderstanding of what's going on in the creation of art is fundamental to this idea that somehow art has been taken over by people who have evil intent, and that the world is at great risk.
And I guess one of the ideas, too, is that these sometimes these institutions need to be criticized.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that and nor is that criticism un-American, nor is that criticism necessarily debilitating. So I think that the give and take that happens in a normal democratic discourse, when it's reduced to a set of criteria, leads paranoid people to believe that bad things are happening, and that the, you know, if you might want to know how we survived the 40s or the 50s or the 60s or the 70s, because each era has these kind of scares.
John, do you the FBI investigated films like It's a Wonderful Life. Did it investigate a lot of other films as well in the 1940s?
Well, it was keeping files regularly on a whole series of movies. There was only a short period of time when it was looking at content. And during that time, movies like The Best Years of Our Lives, which I just mentioned, which won the Academy Award in 1946, was analyzed as subversive. An Arthur Miller play turned into a movie called All My Sons, which was about fraud and corruption in manufacturing during the war, was considered subversive. Gentleman's Agreement, which was about anti-Semitism, was considered subversive. So there's a series of movies around that time, maybe close to 20, who were analyzed and determined to be subversive by the FBI.
My final question is, there was a lot of fear generated by the suspicion that there were communists active not only in Hollywood but around the country, and it really took hold of the country for a while. The country was in the grip of that scare. Is there any protection from returning to those times where the country was in the grip of fear that some sort of alien ideology was about to take over, and using the media to take over? I mean, could we return to those times?
So interestingly enough, we tend to celebrate HUAC because we celebrate the end of HUAC. So when HUAC is discussed, and discussed in the media and talked about, you tend to see the clip where a lawyer whose name I'm forgetting sort of challenges the committee as having no morals or dignity.
The Army McCarthy hearings.
That's right. So it's the Army McCarthy hearings. And then that's sort of our image, which is we stood up to this. HUAC was very effective. Movies became very dull in terms of this kind of back and forth about ideas for a good decade. And I would argue they were quite successful at sort of tamping down a lot of democratic discourse. I think you could see parallels to what's going on here in all sorts of places in the contemporary world. I think discussions about the role of violence and sex in movies have aspects of this in it. I think, I think that Fox News's discussions of, discussions about the war on Christmas have aspects of this. I think it's a fairly common form, and it can go, it can get extreme as it did in the 40s and 50s, but generally speaking, it doesn't work, and we survive it fairly well. So I think we'll continue to see instances of it, and I think we should engage in that cultural argument when we see it. But I'm not particularly fearful that we are about to enter into the 1950s again.
John Noakes, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WMNF. Are you going to watch It's a Wonderful Life this
sure.
year?
I do every year.
John, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was John Noakes, who was at that point a professor at Franklin and Marshall College, and he had written a book called The Cold War in the Movies. And we were talking about the FBI's investigation into the subversive communist nature of It's a Wonderful Life. And It's a Wonderful Life will appear several times on TV over the next few days, including on NBC tomorrow night, which is an annual event there. The FBI claimed that two of its main screenwriters, Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, associated with communists. Well, I think it's fair to say that It's a Wonderful Life is subversive. If you are an opponent of wealth consolidation, if you're skeptical of big business, if you're against greed, you think that workers and immigrants should be celebrated and viewed as important parts of our economy. Jimmy Kimmel on ABC TV a few years ago rearranged It's a Wonderful Life and said, what would happen if Fox News was around when It's a Wonderful Life came out in 1946? And let's listen to Jimmy Kimmel's send-up of how Fox News views, might view, It's a Wonderful Life.
This Christmas, rediscover the heartwarming story of the sleepy, economically backwards town of Bedford Falls.
Nobody ever changes here, you know that.
And it's one extraordinary citizen, Henry Potter.
I may lose a fortune, but I am willing to guarantee your people too.
This capitalist had a dream to transform Bedford Falls into a modern entertainment and business mecca, creating hundreds of new jobs. But one man would stand in his way.
You remember me, George Bailey?
Draft Dodger George Bailey and his socialist building and loan.
We've got to have faith in each other.
Will Henry Potter's common sense reforms win the day?
What does that get us? A discontented, lazy rabble instead of a thrifty working class?
Or will George Bailey succeed with his scheme to redistribute wealth?
They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait, wait for what?
How far will Bailey go to destroy free markets and economic progress? How low will he sink?
Where's that money, you silly, stupid old fool?
This Christmas, enjoy a classic as it was meant to be understood. Fox News presents Mr. Potter and the Commies of Bedford Falls.
Okay, so what would happen if Fox News got a hold of It's a Wonderful Life and made it Mr. Potter the hero? Well, let's open up the phone lines. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. And as always, I'm always on the lookout this time of year for the best movies to watch this time of year. So if you've got a suggestion, I'll take it. Jack writes this regarding the pardons that the president gave. These pardons are really draining the swamp, he says sarcastically. And Jack goes on to write, to all those law and order people in favor of keeping lawbreakers off the streets, they should have second thoughts about who they put in office in 2016. That's Jack in Palm Harbor. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Let's see if I can bring up some more of these emails here in a second. Okay, of course, everything crashes here. Well, let's take some phone calls, and Jessica Green is our phone producer today. Jessica, thank you for coming in, and we always enjoy having you here. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. And we'll take some phone calls right now here on WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Rob in Thanota, Sassa. Hey, Rob, you're on MNF. What's up?
Hey, Rob. It's an excellent topic. Brought to mind a couple of, well, one book I have in particular called Tender Comrades by a couple guys, Patrick Gilligan and Paul Boulay, I believe it is. And essentially, it profiles 36 or so different people who were under attack by the by HUAC. And it's fascinating. And as you pointed out, many were, I mean, if not outright communists, many were very sympathetic to the party. There was one couple that wrote a book. She wrote a book of her own. Her name is Norma Bartzman, and her husband, Ben. And they were actually both screenwriters, and they were under investigation. I think someone gave their name up, and they had to flee to France. France was actually kind of a safe haven for, I think, a few of those people. And they lived there until it blew over. But, you know, the thing you mentioned about the Soviet Union did kind of cover up a lot of its misdeeds under Stalin, and then they did have a sort of positive profile because of World War II. So it was really, you know, it wasn't like people were supporting the Stalinist Russia that had these purges, because those were largely unknown here, I think. And, you know, after Khrushchev kind of revealed all of the crimes of Stalin, I think a lot of support of the hardcore left communist direct support faded. But this book is fascinating, and it really did destroy so many of the lives of these attention people. You know, they weren't trying to bring totalitarianism down on America. They were trying to have a more compassionate, humanistic sort of approach to living.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think they were champions of working people at the time. They didn't want a repressive government, but they did want better working conditions. And because you see some of the pictures of factories in the 20s and 30s in this country, and they were really there were some oppressive conditions that people on the left were trying to overcome.
What's that book by Upton Sinclair, The Jungle? Isn't it called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair?
Yeah.
About the meat packing industry?
Yeah.
Yeah, horrible things. And, you know, I think maybe a lot of people don't understand that many of the reforms, and you've pointed this out, that, you know, everything from a minimum wage to a 40-hour week, overtime pay, health care. I mean, all of these things were brought about by people on the left. And before that, you know, it was if you cut your hand off in a textile mill, you know, they give you a tin can with some pencils in it if you survive, you know, and you're out on a street corner.
Yeah, I often think about people on the left being ahead of their time when it comes to civil rights or when it comes to minimum wage or 40-hour work week. I mean, these are all things that we consider part of, you know, it's part of America today.
Yeah, the fabric of our culture, you know, it's not seen, yeah.
But when they were first proposed, these were radical ideas. Equal pay for women, we haven't achieved it yet, but those, you know, 50 or 80 years ago, that was a radical idea. Now I think everybody kind of agrees to it, we just haven't achieved it. But these are all ideas that did come from the left, and eventually they win. So today we're having a big debate about health care. You see ads on TV from insurance companies and others trying to say that the Democrats want to take over the entire health care system. I mean, I think we're entering a big debate about the future of health care.
Well, I think what's interesting, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you. But, all you have to do is look at what Ronald Reagan was saying when, you know, well before he was even, I think when he was governor, before he was governor, you know, these tirades against Social Security, that it was this communist plot. And now if you tell people, you know, to take away their Social Security, people on both sides will say you're nuts, you know.
Yep, that's true. His tirade was I think actually more against Medicare, and he predicted all sorts of horrible things.
Right.
In fact, he predicted we would lose our freedom because of Medicare.
That's right.
So, as a paid spokesperson for General Electric in the early 1960s, he went around the country and made these speeches, and it turns out he was wrong. We didn't lose our freedom because of Medicare.
I agree with you. Okay, well, great show. I appreciate you.
All right, Rob, thank you. And we've got an open line, 813-239-9663. Terry writes this regarding a film. Terry says, The Front, starring Woody Allen and Zero Mostel, a great film about the blacklisting of 1950s TV writers, actually written and starred in by blacklisted writers from the time. And he says Woody Allen has a really great final scene in that. Yeah, I saw that film when it first came out in the 80s. That is a great film. Jim in Lakeland says, I wonder if anyone had the same views about the remake of this film, a made-for-television gender-bender version starring Marlo Thomas. It was retitled It Happened One Christmas. How anyone could have connected either of these as being subversive is unimaginable, writes Jim in Lakeland. I didn't see that. I know that there was supposed to be a table reading this year of It's a Wonderful Life involving Ed Asner put it on, but I haven't seen what happened to that. Jeff writes this, if Trump wanted to give people $2,000, might he have some socialist or communist leanings, writes Jeff. Jeff says, I'm confused. Yeah, you know, if you're helping out the working people, and redistributing wealth a little bit, is that a communist inclination? And we heard President Trump at the top of the hour. We played about 4 minutes of his speech from last night, suggesting that $600 is not enough and that the workers of this country and the people of this country need checks for $2,000 each. Jeff, that's a great point. Thank you. Vivian writes this, the original version of The Bishop's Wife with Cary Grant, David Niven, and Loretta Young is fantastic. So there's a movie suggestion for the next few days. Thank you, Vivian. Good to hear from you. And this email comes to us from David, says, I saw a great documentary on Nina Simone called What Happened, Miss Simone. Came out in 2015. It's on Netflix. It's fascinating, writes David. All right, David, I'll look it up. I'm a big Nina Simone fan, as a lot of us down here at WMNFR. And then Mama T in Sarasota writes, a new holiday movie recommendation is Jingle Jangle. My personal favorites, Elf and Die Hard, writes Mama T in Sarasota. Yeah, it's curious that Die Hard, it is a Christmas movie, isn't it? Occupied is on Netflix. It's a political thriller from Norway and Russia. Russia occupies Norway after Norway moves away from oil production. I hadn't heard about that. Okay, so that film is called Occupied. I'll have to make a note of that. Thank you very much. And then Kevin writes this film suggestion in. He says, film noir seems to be the antidote for the A-list movies that were afraid to show a darker side of our culture, but crime, dishonest cops, and femme fatales were a staple of noir, writes Kevin. There are some noir films that include an anti-fascist message, and I'm thinking of a John Garfield film where he comes home from the war and he finds out that he comes home from after serving in the Spanish Civil War, and he comes home to find out that his torturer from the Spanish Civil War is right there in his hometown. And I forgot the name of that film. I saw it a few months ago, but it's a great film. There are big anti-fascist messages in a lot of films, and I think that's part of what the FBI was looking at, too, is were you doing anti-fascist messaging in your film? Were these screenwriters doing that? There's so many great, if you look at the if you look at some of the older films, they really do have a message for today. And I can suggest a few. I just was thinking about this morning. You know, we're in a time where fascist movements are on the rise. And if you watch what our grandfathers were and grandmothers were thinking and watching on movies back in the 30s and 40s, there's some great messages in films like, and I'll just name a few, The Mortal Storm is one, Casablanca is another, Rome Open City is another. I saw a great film the other night. I'd never heard about it. It's called The Seventh Cross, and it's about people who are in a concentration camp. Not all of them are Jewish. In fact, only one person is Jewish in this film who's in the concentration camp. The rest are people that are objecting to the rise of fascism. Spencer Tracy is the lead actor in that, but The Seventh Cross came out in 1944, a great, great message, and it has a message for our time. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, and as we get into the holiday season, kind of winding down a little bit and relaxing a little bit more, and let's go to CJ, who's in Sulphur Springs. Hi, CJ, what would you like to say?
Well, I just like, conception molds a lot of non-reality, but it's conceived to be, so therefore, on some level, it is real for some people who see it in those particular ways. As far as Trump asking for more money, this is the early stages. Everybody can see this. It's the forming early stages of the Trump Party. There's going to be independents, Republicans, Democrats, and Trumpies. And he's beginning to build that because he's got half of the country already, basically. So that's pretty heavy duty to start out with, that much.
But what I always wonder about the Trump Party is, what does he believe in? Because, you know, is it what he believes in day to day? Because it's not written down. We don't know what Trump actually believes. He's not really written a book about his political philosophy. So how do you trust somebody like Trump who may change from day to day his views?
He believes in where he's at the time and his ability to move in and out of different thoughts of what and how and why it exists and the outward stimuli, like people that he uses their money want it back. Oh, that's terrible. That's blasphemous. You know, that money needs to be reinvested. I don't think he's really got much money of his own. He's using a situation to accumulate this being robbed of the election thing. I mean, he's assembling billions of dollars, well, about a half a billion so far. And I'm sure that he'll appropriate that, you know, for whatever purposes he need be legally obligated to do, but that's the thin line he rides.
Yeah, I think that's the danger. I mean, even if you like what Donald Trump says today, how do you know what he's going to say next week or the week after that? What does he really stand for? Thanks, CJ. Good to hear from you. And let's take some more phone calls. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and let's go to Larry in Brooksville. Hi, Larry. You're on MNF.
Hello. I got some very, very pointed things I'd like to put on the air. That man, I'll tell you what, the simplest thing to say is promises made, promises kept. And that's as simple as you can put it. He either accomplished everything he said he was going to do or was in the process thereof.
Well, Larry, let's just take one of those things. I mean, he said that he was going to build a border wall and Mexico was going to pay for it. And he was going to build 2,000 miles of border wall. Another thing that he said was that he was going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something that's more affordable, where you don't have deductibles and everybody can afford it. Now, neither one of those promises came through, and I think those are really important issues. Should we have a border wall, and should we have a better health care system? And he didn't do either one.
Tariff. I said I do believe he was charging Mexico tariffs. Now, how he got the money to do it, that's one thing. But the point is, they were paying for it.
They were paying for it. No. We're paying for it. We are paying for it. You are paying for it. I am paying for it through borrowed dollars. So that didn't happen. Larry, I don't think you're on the right page there, buddy. Let's go to Dan in St. Petersburg. Hey, Dan, you're on MNF. What's up?
Oh, that 4-minute speech that Trump gave about all the money going to foreign country. 5,000 pages in this thing. I'm glad you said that on the air, because I would have no idea what was going on in that bill.
I think we got to look really closely at these bills, and I'm glad the president raised it. I don't always trust the president, so I'm hoping the fact checkers will come out today and tell us what was true about his speech last night and what was not true.
I hear you. You would think it'd be hard to miss. Confuse those. What he?
Yeah, no, I'm not doubting it. I played it, so we'll see where it goes.
Thank you,
Dan. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Mark in Dade City. Hey, Mark, you're on MNF.
Hey, talk about communism. Trump wants you to take the vaccine.
I don't think he wants us to take the vaccine. I just don't think that he wants us to do that. And that was Levi trying to disguise his voice. Let's go to somebody whose first name starts with M-E-N. Men, are you there? Okay. We're having a little bit of phone problems today. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and this is Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori, and let me see if I read some of these emails. This email comes from Jeff. He says, fantastic topic, Rob, and so timely. Is it any great surprise that Blackwater founder Eric Prince is the brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos? After virtually destroying the Michigan public school system, she attempted to do the same with the nation. Why was she even chosen by Trump, writes Jeff in Tampa. Jeff, thank you for that. And then this, let's see, I'm going to not read the anonymous emails that come in. Let's see if I can read something here that's not anonymous. Lou in Plant City says, good holiday movie is Grapes of Wrath, writes Lou of Plant City. Yeah, Grapes of Wrath, one of the great American movies that speech by Henry Fonda's character, just a chilling, chilling speech, haunting speech there by Henry Fonda in that movie. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment about this program on extension 115. And I'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock at the top of the show, Radioactivity. Thanks to Jessica Green. She's been our phone producer today. Coming up in the next hour, Nola will be here, and he'll host the Midpoint program. And I think he's taking calls today. I don't know if he's got a guest, but I think Nola will take your calls today. And thanks a lot for listening to WMNF in Tampa. We hope you have a great holiday season and a happy new year. We'll continue to bring you great programs throughout the holiday season, and we'll be here for you. So thanks for listening. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Let's go up to Washington, D.C. right now and get the latest news.
Live.